Well, hello and welcome to podcast 8 of the History of the United States, or the History of the United States podcast, session number 8. And I think this has only been 10 days in between podcasts, so getting a little better with the timing. Still want to get it to once a week, but well, baby steps, as I said last time. Speaking of last time, we talked about the other European powers that were involved in the settlement of the Americas, namely the French and the Spanish. The Netherlands becomes a little bit of a player, especially after their independence from Spain, but they're not really what you would call a major player in North America, and especially South America. But they do have a couple of notable exceptions, and we'll talk about those in the coming weeks. As you can probably guess, focusing on New Amsterdam and that colony becoming, of course, an English colony, and yet still has ties to its Dutch ancestry, and it's an interesting little mix that we have there. Even so, after King Philip, if you remember, and his failed attempts to subdue England by sea with a number of his armadas, and he failed by supplying the Irish and trying to get them to hector English ships and also create a Catholic uprising in Ireland, that didn't work either and just brought down more pain to the Irish, especially in the north, and the campaign of the English to basically wipe out the Irish and resettle the island with English settlers was really kind of the plan. And that was that's going to be one of the many seeds of what we still have today of Irish and English animosity. Anyway, Philip II passes away, never really accomplishing his goal of a Catholic crusade throughout Western Europe, reuniting all of Europe under the Catholic umbrella. And his son takes the throne, Philip III, who isn't really interested. He wants to kind of make peace, as does Elizabeth's successor as she passes away as well. The crown not going to any direct descendant of hers because she did not have any children, instead passing on to James of Scotland, and making him the James I of England, and I think James VI of Scotland. Even so, they basically get together, and the hostilities, especially throughout the Mediterranean, throughout Europe, have pretty much stopped. And part of the peace that they have is that the English will be allowed to settle in the Americas without being disturbed by the Spanish fleet. So, a much better environment than when Elizabeth sent colonists, really, businessmen sent colonists over to the Americas that were constantly being harassed and whatnot from various foes, Native Americans, the Spanish, bad weather, you name it. Anyway, the English eventually settle and are able to have a thriving colony. So it would be the new company, the Virginia Company of London, and the Company of Plymouth would go out from London, or the investors are in London, and allow people to settle under the auspices of being an English settlement. The Plymouth Company sent settlers to the coast of Maine, but they didn't succeed either. But it was the Southern Company that met the most success, and that would be Jamestown, the first real thriving colony of the English that we'll see. And you probably have heard things about it and whatnot. And Jamestown did have a unfortunate time going through. There is a story of, you know, it getting to be the springtime, and people got on ships and were ready to sail back to England. And if it hadn't been for the fact that they basically saw the English ships coming to give them supplies and kind of refurbish them, Jamestown may have met the fate of many other colonies of the English. Anyway, this is also where we get the story of John Smith, who was the military leader of the colony. And he tries to raid the Native Americans in the area, the Powhatan tribe, and take their food supply. John Smith, unfortunately for him anyway, is captured, and he claims to be freed by the daughter of the chief of the tribe, Pocahontas. But it seems that Smith, in various other military campaigns, used the same story, at least two other times, of being saved by a young girl related to the leader of wherever he was. So I don't know why he would keep using this story, but you know, it must have made a better story than just escaping, but being freed by a young, innocent, quote unquote, savage made it a more interesting story for people to relate to. So, I don't know. Even so, after many administrators of the colony who were either inept, corrupt, or a little bit of both. There's one of the administrators who never left the ships of the colony, and then they decided to go back to England. By 1609, John Smith is left in control of Jamestown, and he ultimately makes it run like a military camp. And so it was doing okay, but due to other concerns, Smith had to leave. I think he had gotten sick or wounded. I can't remember. But after Smith leaves, discipline breaks down, and scarcity, which was always a problem in the colony, came back, and there are tales of starvation, and there is even now proof of cannibalism taking place in the Jamestown colony. There was a very interesting Washington Post article going over basically a butchered young woman, and just detailing how, you know, after the initial death blow, the cuts on her bones and such things were done by a skilled butcher, and that's really disturbing to think about. Even so, even through these really rough times, new colonists still arrive, and they do begin to demand that the Native Americans, the Powhatan, submit to English rule. Not really the best way to go, but Pocahontas is captured by the English. She did actually exist, and she converts to Christianity and marries John Rolfe. And they do manage to, after a pretty lengthy military campaign, do manage to have a peace between the Native Americans and the English settlers. The one thing, though, that truly makes Jamestown thrive, and then later the Chesapeake area thrive, is the, not discovery, that's probably the wrong word, but the cultivation of tobacco. Tobacco becomes the number one cash crop. It is going to lead to a very wealthy colonial atmosphere. Tobacco becomes the craze of England and Europe. It is, you know, the first real return on the investment of all the companies. So in order to get more people into these colonies, they started, the companies, that is, started what they called a headright system. So for however many people you brought, that is how much land you would get. And I don't have the numbers on that. But so if you were a family of four, you got a bigger amount of land than, say, if you just came over as a single man. So the idea was to foster this growing community. Also, one of the interesting things, the first representative government in the Americas is founded, as far as we would term it. In 1619, the House of Burgesses in Virginia is founded. And it's a pretty cool thing that people had a representative government. I think that's kind of neat. The company the Virginia Company, could still veto any decisions that the Burgesses came up with, any laws, any things like that. But they gave him a pretty fair amount of rein. I mean, it is, after all, across the ocean. I mean, by the time they would pass it, word would get back to London. I'm sure that in some cases they were already operating under the laws that they created, and that it kind of became almost a, you know, a fiat accompli, to use a fancy term. You know, but even so, if they waited that much time after they passed things, I'm sure it's still, I can't imagine there was a lot of vetoes. I wonder, that would be an interesting thing to study. Kind of where that root of English-American division maybe gets started and stuff like that. That's something to look into one day. Anyway, the Chesapeake Bay, like I said, is booming at this point. Tobacco is big. Farming is doing well now. There is a war that lasts for almost 10 years. It is with the Algonquin tribes in the area. And the English are very much different than the Spanish and the French. They are, now this isn't to say that it didn't happen, but there is no acceptance of a mixing of the races. The English will have none of it. This is a sin. This is debasing. This is all kinds of awful things, according to the English. And really, truly, the tactics that the English use against the Native Americans are pretty much the exact same ones that they used against the Irish in Elizabeth's time. As a matter of fact, some of the first settlers throughout the Chesapeake and the Carolina area were part of the Irish subjugation as well. Sir Francis Drake took part in the conquest of Ireland. Sir Walter Raleigh. Anyway, they both took part of the subjugation of Ireland, and they come to the colonies, and they pretty much engage in the exact same thing, which is not even just subjugation, but really, for lack of a better term, extermination. It really is almost a genocidal goal that they have in mind. There are a lot of accounts from people like Drake and Raleigh and others of how much the Native Americans remind them of the Irish. So you also get this idea of racial identity already creeping in, and that the English have their idea, and I guess if you're Scottish, you somehow fit into that, I'm guessing. But the Irish were definitely not seen as civilized, not seen as, really, for lack of a better term, white, Christian, because, of course, they practiced Catholicism and in a more mystical way than a lot of other places. So it was really seen as this almost paganish kind of practice that they had. So the Native Americans reminded them a great deal of the Irish, because they had that worldview. And this is going to have a lot of implications going forward. The one person who we see really moving Virginia in a set direction with a vision in mind is Sir William Berkeley. And he becomes the governor of Virginia for 34 years. And he will really shape Virginia the way he wants to. And the way he wants to do that is basically bringing English society to the colonies. And in order to do that, he tries to recruit as many aristocratic people over. He recruits, as they're called, cavaliers, nobles loyal to the King of England, and I'll talk more about why that's such an important thing later on, to govern and rule. He definitely was setting up a hierarchy. And Berkeley, one of his more famous quotes is, "I love liberty, but I hate equality." So This isn't the birth of democracy by any stretch. He is recruiting a workforce predominantly from the south and west of England, which was a loyalist stronghold, loyal to the King of England. He also ramps up the idea of indentured servitude. So he definitely is setting up what he thinks is the model for society. And it may be hard to kind of get around that idea that liberty is one thing and equality is another, and freedom is yet another. But in Berkeley's view, and then later on in really the descendants in Virginia, I mean, this idea of liberty not being the same as equality, not necessarily sharing that bond, is what makes people like Thomas Jefferson, you know, able to exist. That I don't think Jefferson ever would have said, oh no, everybody, you know, is on equal playing field. Now, yes, he wrote, all men are created equal, but that doesn't mean in society the same thing. That then, of course, there are different levels and things like that. And the same thing when you think of Patrick Henry, you know, it wasn't give me freedom, it wasn't give me all kinds of different things, it wasn't give me equality, it was give me liberty or give me death. And I think over time, that we've kind of conflated the two ideas of liberty and equality and freedom. So, you know, we've kind of made it into all these different things that we celebrate on the 4th of July yesterday and that sort of thing. But to Berkeley and then his descendants, they were very different. You could have a rich ruling class. You could have slaves and still be a free, liberated society. That was okay. And I think that's kind of the worldview that they were sharing at that time. Anyway, one of the more interesting things that kind of puts that to the test is something that's called Bacon's Rebellion, which happens in Virginia as well. I have to admit, when I was first introduced to history and things, I didn't know much about Bacon's Rebellion. And now I find it one of the more fascinating things in American history. Because it is on one hand, one of the worst on all sides. There's nobody really to root for in this whole thing. Leading up to Bacon's Rebellion, there were still many border skirmishes, English settlement trying to expand, Native Americans resisting, the government / Berkeley, their plan was to basically create a perimeter, make that safe. So create a series of forts and patrols through the forts and things like that to keep the Native Americans out of the English settlement. Many other people, instead of paying higher taxes and such things to create a militia, to create forts and all that kind of stuff, thought, well, why don't we just keep what we're doing in kind of this Irish/genocidal model and just go through and just root out the Native Americans root and branch and be done with it. This was especially popular with smaller farmers, people living on the hinterlands that, you know, I mean, if the patrol's not around and you live far away from a fort, you know, there's a really good chance that you could still be raided. So smaller farmers, landholders still, and many indentured servants want some kind of, you know, they want to keep a different kind of plan going. And one guy, Nathan Bacon, or is it Nathaniel? Nathaniel Bacon. So it's not Nathan. Anyway, Nathaniel Bacon, who was a distant relative of Berkeley, comes to Virginia in about 1676 and decides that he is going to just take matters into his own hands. And his strategy basically is to go through anywhere, even Native American places that were trying to be peaceful, that were trying to cooperate with the English. That's it. They were going to go and slaughter them and make it safe for English settlement. This doesn't go over very well with Berkeley, because he was trying to build a different way, but also, you know, going against your allies is never a good thing. It makes things even harder going forward. So he ultimately says for Berkeley to come back to Jamestown and be done with this. And he was going to censure Bacon and not allow him to do this anymore. Instead, Bacon comes back to Jamestown, and they don't lay down their arms or cede to the government's power. They go in with guns a-blazing and sack the settlement of Jamestown, actually forcing Berkeley to leave the settlement. And Bacon is basically having a coup, or a coup is occurring in Virginia over this. And right pretty much at the moment of triumph for Nathaniel Bacon, he contracts dysentery and dies. Many of his followers are then dispersed without the leader. The rebellion kind of flounders. Berkeley is able to come back and reassert his authority. Now, keep in mind how this goes about. This isn't just disobeying orders at this point, right? This is a group of people that you would hope were following the hierarchy, the societal model of listening to the aristocrats, listening to your betters, doing as you're told, working where you're told, not going out and doing things that they didn't like, especially then turning around and, well, trying to conquer Jamestown itself. So, what do you do? In Berkeley's case, there's a couple of things. You could give people more rights, so they feel a little more vested in the whole system, or you could create more restrictions and clamp down even harder. As it turns out, Berkeley is going to follow a course that's a little bit of both. Certain people are going to get more rights and feel a little more vested in the system. Other people are going to have a lot more rights restricted and taken away. But that is for next time. And this did come up a little bit shorter than I usually do, but that's okay. Give everybody a little bit of a break. I hope you had a great 4th of July. Kind of a bummer we didn't get a little closer to the American Revolution to talk about on the 4th of July, but, well, what do you do? Anyway, if you have any comments or questions, please feel free to drop me a line at KAUFMAK, Kaufmack, at yahoo.com. And until then, this is the History of the United States podcast.